is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
From the outside, the Delphi case has always looked deceptively simple. Two young girls vanish on a February afternoon. A grainy image from a cell phone captures a man walking on a bridge. A muffled voice says, "Down the hill." And for years, investigators insist they are closing in. People assume the machinery is working. The process is functioning. Somewhere behind the curtain are meticulous detectives mapping timelines, comparing evidence and pulling threads until the truth emerges. People want to believe that. People need to believe that. Because the alternative, the possibility that an investigation of this magnitude was just not flawed, but fractured, is almost too unsettling to consider. But the depositions have now ripped the curtain away. And once you read them, once you sit with the contradictions, once you hear investigators contradicting each other, contradicting themselves, contradicting the very documents they wrote and swore by, once you understand how much was withheld, how much was minimized, how much was simply ignored, you realize something no one in authority ever wanted to admit. This case wasn't just complicated. It was compromised. Not necessarily through corruption, not through conspiracy, but through something far more common and more dangerous in the criminal justice system. A chaotic, disorganized, internally conflicted investigation that never found its grounding. It begins with the agencies themselves, the Indiana State Police, the Carroll County Sheriff's Office, the FBI. Three power structures, three cultures, three timelines, and three versions of reality. One of the lead investigators swore under oath that Superintendent Doug Carter personally kicked the FBI out of the Delphi investigation. Not a polite thank you for your service, not a routine scaling back. He said, "Carter, shut the bureau out of the room." A federal agency, one of the most experienced investigative entities in violent crime, removed from a double homicide investigation of two children. That should have been front page news. Instead, it wasn't mentioned publicly at all. It wasn't acknowledged in press conferences. It wasn't reflected in statements. It was buried inside a deposition until the defense unearthed it. And then unbelievably, another investigator, someone who worked hand in hand with the first, denied it ever happened. Said he had no knowledge of the FBI being removed. Said Carter had nothing to do with that decision. The two testimonies cannot coexist in the same universe. One is true or neither is, but they can't both be. And that theme, internal contradiction, repeats through every corner of this case. Take the behavioral analysis unit. In most states, in most investigations, when the BAU weighs in, people listen. It's not gospel, but it is significant. They've profiled serial killers, ritual killers, spree killers, lone offenders, group offenders. They've identified patterns in scenes most investigators have never encountered. And when you examined Delphi, when they examined Delphi early on, their reported conclusion was stunning. Indicators of Nordic belief systems, Odinism, ritualistic staging, symbolic elements coming from the FBI, not just some guy in the woods going, "You know, this kind of looks like a TV show I saw once. Kind of Nordic-y." No, this is the behavioral analysis unit of the FBI saying, "We think this might be what's going on down here." And what did the Delphi local investigators do? "Nah, we're good. Can you step out of the room, please?" It is without question one of the most consequential assessments made in this entire investigation, one that the jury heard nothing of. And yet investigators barely remember it. One says he doesn't recall the BAU giving that opinion. Another seems to recall something, but not enough to give details. No one memorialized it in official reports. No one documented how much weight it carried. No one followed up. No one seems to know why such a major conclusion was essentially erased from the internal record of the case. Then, 6 years after the murders, a small-town assistant police chief in Rushville, someone not even assigned to Carroll County, writes a memo outlining Odinist suspects, symbolic parallels, runic patterns, blood correspondence, social media connections, and in that memo, he references the BAU assessment. It survived only because he wrote it down, not because anyone at the top of the investigation treated it as important. And once the internal chaos becomes clear, the timeline, the supported backbone or supposed backbone of this case, it all starts to fall apart under its own weight. Investigators pretended the timeline was definitive. Abby and Libby arrive at the trail at a certain time. The man is spotted around a certain time. Witnesses place him nearing the bridge. And all of it leads, they say, to one logical conclusion. Richard Allen was there. He was the man on the bridge. He encountered the girls. He committed the murders. Never mind the man on the tape on the bridge looks nothing like Richard Allen. Never mind, there's really no conclusive evidence to show that the man on the bridge had anything to do with the murders. So when you go back to the actual witness statements, not the summaries, not the press releases, not the affidavits, the deposition testimony reveals something else entirely. There is a witness who saw a man and a vehicle that day. She describes a man as young, early 20s, poofy hair, not a grown man in his 40s. She describes the car as older, something from the 60s, a Ford Comet style. Boxy, angular, absolutely not a black Ford Focus. She told investigators this twice. Yet, the search warrant affidavit drafted by Sheriff Tony Liggett, sworn to be truthful, claims her statement was consistent with Allen. The affidavit omits her description entirely. It's consistent with Allen, even though it's not at all. It does not mention her saying the vehicle looked nothing like Allen's. It doesn't mention her stating the man looked far younger. It doesn't mention the hair, the build, the age. It doesn't mention anything. Just a quick little, it's consistent with. The affidavit simply transforms her into a witness who supports the theory they had already committed to. It's not a small error. It isn't a misremembered detail. This is altering the meaning of a witness statement to justify a search, and when a judge signs off on a warrant based on that altered meaning, every piece of evidence that follows becomes legally and ethically vulnerable. The same thing happened with other witnesses. One statement was framed in a way that suggested Allen had more time than he did. Another was paraphrased to imply a sighting that never fully matched. Crucial context went missing. And for all the talk investigators have done publicly about how thoroughly every lead was vetted, the third-party suspects, the two men, the defense argues, were connected both symbolically and physically to the crime, were barely touched. One of them, after being interviewed, after having his DNA taken, turned back towards the trooper who just questioned him and asked whether he'd be in trouble if his spit were found on one of the girls. That is the kind of statement that in any competent investigation would generate some urgency. Follow-ups, search warrants, surveillance, something. But in this case, they dropped it. Classified as no further leads. The investigative equivalent of a shrug. The other man connected through social media to Odinist symbolism, to images that disturbingly resembled the crime scene. to memes about helping move a body 3 days after the murders to a 40 caliber handgun that investigators never once seized or tested, who was dismissed as no further leads. And here's where the contradictions get even more dramatic. Investigators have insisted for years this was a lone wolf attack, a single man acting alone in the woods. But inside the depositions, the cracks show again. One investigator says one offender. Another says multiple offenders seem likely based on the complexity of the scene, the staging, the arrangement, the distance bodies were carried, the absence of drag marks, the time window, the terrain. But even that internal disagreement isn't the real problem. The problem is how little physical evidence was collected to resolve those differences. The sticks placed on the girls' bodies, a visual centerpiece of the crime scene, were left untouched for days, not hours, days. In any properly handled homicide, those items would have been photographed, documented, collected, analyzed, cataloged, matched for origin, tested for DNA, examined for symbolic patterns. Here, they weren't even removed on day one. No one measured them. No one diagrammed them. No one tried to determine whether they were moved, placed, arranged, or ritualistic. And when a blood spatter expert was finally brought in 7 years after the murders, the job he was asked to do was not examine the crime scene. It was to look at photos. The bullet is perhaps the most troubling example. The single unspent round that prosecutors relied on to argue that Allen's gun had been racked with force at the scene, leaving behind a casing that matched the Sig Sauer. This piece of evidence was foundational in the state's argument that Allen's gun was present and functional during the murders. And what documentation exists of the bullet at the scene? None. No photograph of it lying where it was found. No image of investigators picking it up. No record of the evidence technician who bagged it. Nothing. Only photos of the photo inside a lab after it arrived from the scene, a crucial piece of evidence with an invisible origin. And a defense attorney, or if I should say a defense attorney, presented a piece of evidence with that level of documentation or lack thereof, the state would tear them apart. They would call it unreliable, questionable, compromised. How it even got in. But here, because the state processed it, because it fit the narrative, the lack of documentation became an inconvenience rather than a glaring problem. And the background of all this is the discovery timeline, a timeline that, when viewed through the depositions, looks less like a mistake and more like systematic failure. In May of 2023, the Rushville assistant chief sent a letter to the prosecutor's office. Attached were 85 pages of Odinist suspect research, interviews, digital files, symbolic interpretations, connections, dates, imagery, and references to the behavioral analysis unit's analysis, material that any competent investigator would want and that any defense team is legally entitled to, material that could support alternative suspects, material that complicates the lone offender narrative the state was married to. The prosecutor did not hand this over immediately, not in June, not in July, not in August. The defense received this potentially exculpatory package in September, 4 months later, after multiple court hearings and discovery battles. Meanwhile, pretrial rulings were being made by a judge who did not have the full picture. Evidence was being barred before it was even seen. Experts were being blocked before being heard. And because the defense didn't yet have the Odinist evidence, they couldn't effectively argue why it mattered. It isn't a procedural misstep. This is a failure that cuts directly to due process. And yet when investigators were asked under oath why certain leads were closed, why certain decisions were made, the answers were vague. They talked about lack of follow-up, no further leads, nothing substantial. They spoke as though these decisions were obvious, self-explanatory. But when you line their statements up with the evidence they ignored, the contradictions become unavoidable. One example, investigators have repeatedly claimed there were no drag marks on the ground, suggesting the bodies were carried. But that alone raised enormous questions. Carried by who? One investigator suggested one person, another said multiple or more likely. Another insisted one offender again. The bodies are heavy. The terrain was uneven. The distance is meaningful. And the forensic evidence, what little exists, doesn't resolve the dispute. Another, the sticks placed on the girls' bodies. One investigator testifies they were for concealment. Another suggests it was camouflage. Then a prosecutor at trial floats the idea of an undoing, a psychological concept that investigators never previously invoked. This was the prosecution's own idea, and yet when the defense argued that this opened the door to discussing alternative symbolic meanings, including Odinist interpretations, the judge slammed that door shut hard. This is a pattern, and the depositions are the roadmap. The deeper you go, the more chaotic the entire investigative process becomes. It looks reactive rather than proactive. It looks like an investigation that never stabilized, that never locked in its internal logic, that changed direction whenever pressure increased, and that ultimately settled on a suspect because they needed one, not because the evidence demanded one. There are moments in the depositions where investigators refer to their own decisions as unclear, where they admit they don't recall major events, where they acknowledge that important leads were sidelined without full investigation, where they contradict themselves on issues as basic as what happened to the FBI. And here's the most important part. This isn't about the defense making accusations. These contradictions come straight from the people who led the case. Those gaps come from their own mouths. The inconsistencies aren't a narrative being imposed. They are the narrative revealed through sworn statements. When you take it all together, the behavioral analysis unit's early conclusion, the internal conflict about the FBI's role, the manipulated witness statements, the discarded third-party suspects, the symbolic indicators, the poor evidence collection, the bullet documentation gaps, the late discovery disclosures, the contradictions about lone versus multiple offenders, the selective emphasis on some evidence and neglect of other evidence. You're left with an investigation that doesn't point clearly to any truth. It points to uncertainty, inconsistency, and a very fractured process. And that fractured process is what Richard Allen will now be judged by on appeal. It's what the appellate court will have to weigh. It's what will determine whether this conviction stands or whether an entirely new phase of this case is about to begin. It's what leaves the community in Delphi, and frankly, the entire country, with a question no one wants to face, but everyone now has to confront. What if this case wasn't solved? What if the wrong questions were asked? What if the right questions were ignored? What if the evidence collected wasn't the evidence needed? What if the truth was always there, but the investigation wasn't structured to find it? What if the real story of Delphi isn't just about what happened to Abby and Libby, but what happened to the investigation meant to bring them justice? Because the depositions don't lie. The records don't lie. The contradictions don't lie. The missing pieces don't lie. The delayed disclosures don't lie. Someone, somewhere, at some point, will have to face the fact that the architecture of this investigation is not what it was presented to be. And when that reckoning comes, whether it happens in appellate court or federal court or public opinion, it's going to shake everything. And hopefully, the right people will be held accountable. Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and you'll find us. I'd love to get your thoughts on this case. If you're not already, press subscribe, please do it. We're trying to get to 100,000 by the end of the year. We're getting close. We can do it with your help, maybe. So please do hit subscribe. And do it wherever you're listening to as well. If it's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever, so you don't miss any of our coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender, juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For a limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.